Welcome to the Australian Institute of Administrative Law podcast. My name is Margaret Tregurtha. I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture. We pay our respects to elders past and present. AIAL aims to raise awareness and promote discussion of issues in the law of government in Australia. I can think of few figures in the Australian administrative law landscape who are as well qualified to speak on that topic as our guest today, Professor John McMillan. John's impact on the study and practice of administrative law is significant. It extends into academia, government administration, law reform, private practice, and professional bodies. I doubt there is a role relating to admin law that John has not performed at some point in his career. He's also a former president of the Australian Institute of Administrative Law and has played a very active role in the Institute over many years. John's service to administrative law as Commonwealth Ombudsman and through his other leadership roles was recognised when he was made an Officer of the Order of Australia in 2010. We very much appreciate John giving us his time to talk about his administrative law career and his involvement with the AIAL. Welcome, John.
Good morning, Margaret. And thank you very much for that warm and flattering introduction.
So you've had a very full life in administrative law, which I've just briefly touched on in the introduction. Could you say a bit more about the range of things that you have done?
My career path has followed three different lines, Margaret. One is I was an academic for many years at three institutions, initially in the law faculty of the University of New South Wales, then for a while at the Australian Graduate School of Management, and the longest academic stint was at the Australian National University in the College of Law there for 20 years. The second theme in my career was that I was a statutory office holder in four positions: Commonwealth Ombudsman, the Integrity Commissioner acting for the Australian Commission for Law Enforcement Integrity, Australian Information Commissioner, and then acting New South Wales Ombudsman for about 2.5 years. And two of those positions, I established the office. I established ACLEI, and I established the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner. The third theme that's kind of run in tandem with that activity has been an involvement in public interest advocacy activity at various times, particularly in the early stage of my academic career. I was very active in promoting the need for administrative law reform, for public law reform generally on matters like whistleblower protection, reform of the laws of standing, access to justice, and the like. For a while, I worked full-time just on a private capacity on public interest work. And indeed, one of the more interesting activities in which I engaged was during my study leave, academic study leave back in 1976. I worked with Ralph Nader's Freedom of Information Clearinghouse in Washington, D.C. for about 5 months.
Certainly a very sort of wide spectrum of different kinds of roles, and we'll ask some questions that sort of go to those things a bit later on. But before we do that, I'd be pleased if you'd be able to sort of give us a bit of your sort of personal background. You've been in Canberra for many years, but perhaps you could tell us a bit about your background, your family, and where you grew up.
Margaret, I was born in Canberra, and indeed I have a connection extending even longer. My father was born in Canberra in 1920, so we have a long-standing connection with a place that was just a small regional outpost then. Most of my life I have lived in Canberra. During my early years I lived in Young in regional New South Wales and commenced schooling there. I have, I must say, only happy memories of growing up in small country towns, and in Canberra life was very easy. I remember never planning more than about 2 hours ahead at any stage in my life, and indeed that extended in part into university years where activities occurred, jobs popped up. There was none of the need for long-sighted planning that people face now. So my connection with Canberra is a very strong one, and one of which I have strong and very fond memories.
And so, John, what made you decide to choose to study law and then particularly to focus on administrative law?
Again, it was an activity that I've kind of fell into. There was no family connection with the legal profession, no background in law. Indeed, I was the first member of my family to go to university, indeed the first member of my family to complete high schooling. So I had no clear career aspirations. I was, during my high school years, interested in public speaking and in acting in the local repertory society, and my father casually said to me one day that maybe I should study law because that involved speaking or advocacy as well, and that seemed like a good idea. And so I enrolled in law and thoroughly enjoyed the study at ANU. ANU, during the period that I studied, was particularly strong in administrative law. A number of great figures were there, Harry Whitmore, Dennis Pierce, Jack Richardson, Leslie Zines, Jeff Lindell, and so I developed a strong interest in public law through my association with them. Particularly my association with Harry Whitmore, who was my administrative law teacher and then later the supervisor of my honours thesis on government secrecy. And so it was through my really excellent teaching and mentoring for people of that caliber that I strengthened my interest in public law.
And do you think that was what sort of led you into the academic pathway in the first instance, and what took you back to the ANU?
Yes, that was certainly a strong influence. At the time that I was studying, when it was fairly prominent in, sort of career planning that if you were doing well in law, then a career as an academic was something that you should seriously consider. I think that's aspiration has probably dwindled significantly in recent decades, but certainly it was a very strong influence at the time. So the option of an academic career was something that certainly occurred to me in my later years of study. But then, once again, there's an element of just unpredictability and happenstance that determines one's career path. My first job after graduation was as associate to Sir Anthony Mason. And towards the end of my period with him, he asked what was I planning to do, and I said I had a rough idea of going into legal practice. So he suggested he'd write me a reference, and on the evening when he was writing a reference, Harry Whitmore, a friend also of his, rang him, and Sir Anthony mentioned to Harry that he was doing a reference, and Harry, who was then the Dean of Law at UNSW, said, "Oh, well, we're hiring academics. Get John to give me a call." So I gave a call. Again, in those days, it was a matter of going for an interview the following week, being appointed a week after. And so I then commenced an academic career. So it's those kind of forks in the road that you you take one path and you find that it influences your career in ways that reflect sort of accidental actions rather than long-term planning.
And certainly, you know, you've had a few different forks in the road, as you mentioned sort of earlier on, that, you know, diverting from academia into sort of government and administration and law reform and other types of activities. So, given you've worked in a range of different roles across administrative law, what do you think have been some of your hardest challenges?
Margaret, each of the statutory positions that I've held has brought a unique challenge. As Commonwealth Ombudsman, I took leadership of an office that had been going well for about 25 years, but was kind of motoring along. And so the real challenge was to develop the relevance of the office in a very practical way and bring it back to the centre of the administrative law system. Indeed, a predecessor said to me that a comment that struck her from an agency head was the comment, "You know, you'll only ever be peripheral." And so I thought that was the real challenge in the Ombudsman's office, to demonstrate that the office had a central role to play and was not just peripheral to the other activity of government. The next statutory position, heading the establishing the Australian Commission for Law Enforcement Integrity, I believed strongly in the need for integrity and anti-corruption commissions, though it was very clear to me at that time when I took the acting appointment that the Commonwealth government was not particularly interested in having an integrity commission. So that was a difficult challenge of again building the profile of the office and conveying to government that its relevance was needed. Indeed, a major way I did that was agreed to do an interview with the Australian newspaper that was got front page treatment, really criticising the poor support and funding that the office was receiving from government, and that seemed to have made a difference. Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, that was a new office with which I had a strong, for which I had a strong interest, given my own background in promoting the need for freedom of information reform. But the OIAC was to bring together privacy, information policy, and access to government information. So that was a unique challenge. And then finally, the job as acting New South Wales Ombudsman, the role there really was to complete the Operation Prospect report into an unlawful surveillance operation conducted in relation to police. And it was a dispute that had been running for nearly a decade in New South Wales policing, and it bled. It was the single largest ombudsman investigation in Australia, led to a 1,000-page report. It was a real insight into New South Wales, you know, policing and political culture, particularly having to deal with the media, the legal profession, and different elements of government. So, and the only aim was really to complete a report and put this controversy to bed, so that everybody would forget it. So it was an interesting challenge to, you know, to write a 1,000-page report that's major purpose was to bury the idea so that it was no longer a controversy. And I think that was successfully done.
It's certainly a large range of topics there. I think we could make a whole another podcast about some of those things. But I'd like to move on now to talk specifically about the Institute of Administrative Law. You've had a long-term involvement in the Institute, and what was your first experience of it?
My first experience in fact, predated the formal commencement of the Institute, Margaret. I think a pivotal event was a conference that was held in 1989, organised jointly by the ANU Law Faculty, the Administrative Review Council,
the Attorney General's Department and the Institute of Public Administration. And it was really a defining conference called Administrative Law Retrospect and Prospect, the first major conference after about 10 years of, or 15 years of the new administrative law system. And it attracted a whole range of very active and senior people in administrative law from government, the judiciary, academia, community practice. That conference demonstrated, I think, the interest in and need for a regular forum to deal with administrative law. And so in the following year, the first meeting was held in Canberra to establish the AIAL. And I attended the first meeting and became a member of the first executive of AIAL. I organised the first couple of conferences that AIAL held, organised them jointly at the time with the Institute of Public Administration, and then we moved away and ran the conferences individually by ourselves, commenced an AIAL newsletter, which morphed into the very successful AIAL forum. We'll see its 100th issue this year. So that was the early activity, and you know, it's a matter of delight that the foundation, it built a very strong foundation for development of a very vibrant organisation.
And what do you think some of the biggest issues which for the Institute over, you know, what do you think some of the biggest issues are that AIL has been involved in and promoted discussion on?
I suppose I'd mention, firstly, its general work in touching all areas of administrative law practice from different perspectives, from a legal perspective, an academic perspective, a government perspective, a tribunal perspective, and the like. So I think that's been a real strength. And overshadows any, you know, particular topics that it's popularized. But if I were to single out a couple of defining moments, one, for example, was a conference that the, or a half-day seminar that the AIAL organized on tribunal amalgamation when that was first proposed by the government. It was a tribunal, a conference that was held over at Parliament House and had a broad range of participation. And it really knocked off the idea of tribunal amalgamation at the national level for a while until it came back much more recently. Another topic that I think the AIAL has played a key role in is the idea of an integrity or fourth branch of government. The AIAL held a conference on that. It's provided a platform for many of the leading papers that have been delivered on that. Interestingly, it's a topic on which which many senior members of the High Court have given papers, all to discredit the idea. But the fact that they've singled it out as an idea that they wanted to discredit is itself significant. The other topic that I've been particularly delighted the AIAL has provided a strong forum for is the work of ombudsman in Australia. I think the work of the ombudsman has got a lot more prominence as a result of AIAL conferences and forums, and that's been significant in terms of the recognition of in Australia of the importance of independent external complaint handling.
And more broadly, how would you describe the sort of work and the impact of the Institute?
As I indicated earlier, I think its main impact has been that it's created a broad audience to consider administrative law issues and developments. The striking feature of AIAL conferences and of the publications that emerge from them is that it's been a broad audience of people from academia, from government, from community legal practice, from tribunals, from the judiciary, from non-legal practice. And I think the AIAL has been unique in that respect. Certainly, it's been a compliment that has been extended by visiting academics from other countries who've been struck that Australia has this organisation that brings all elements of the community together, whereas the comment is made that in other countries, there tends to be a separate organisation for the academic community, a separate organisation for the legal community. I've been struck too by the important role AIAL has played in that respect when I look at some of the conferences that have been organised, for example, from within legal quarters on administrative law, and it takes a confused, some of them take a confusingly narrow approach that equates judicial review with the development of principles of good decision making. Now, judicial review has a fundamental role to play, but it hardly strikes the diverse range of principles that arise in good decision making. Whereas I think the AIAL's work has been marked for the balanced and diverse perspective it's brought to any aspect of administrative justice.
Yeah, and I certainly think for those of us who've worked in administrative law sort of inside the bureaucracy, that comment you just made is extremely apt, that what makes up good decision making is a wide range of factors. I think that's absolutely right. So do you have any favourite articles from the AIAL forum or a conference paper or lectures that you'd particularly like to highlight? I will note that for the purpose of today's discussion, I did just quickly have a bit of a look, and in my Ausley search, your name came up over 100 times in relation to the AIAL forum. So you've obviously been a big contributor over the years.
Yes, I think the AIAL forum is an ideal forum in which to publish ideas that reach a broad community. Indeed, as an academic, I've often been struck by the readership of my own articles, according to whether they're in a forum like the AIAL forum or in a refereed law journal. Now, the articles that tend to be read and referred to most from the AIAL forum, and I see that from the printouts you get, from the Copyright Society and things like that. So I'm a strong believer of the utility of the forum. And if I just one last comment, in terms of my own articles, probably the one that I'm amusingly proud of the most was one that was written a while ago called Federal Court versus Minister for Immigration, in which I questioned the direction of particularly federal court review, but judicial review generally in relation to immigration decision making. And at the time that article stirred some controversy, I was on a friendly and courteous basis, I was roundly criticised by a number of judges for the tone of the criticism, but was then invited along a couple of times to judicial forums, federal court judges conferences and so on to talk about the research. So I found that interesting. But to put my own writing to one side, some of the definitive articles that I enjoyed and to which I still go back were those from the first couple of years. I mentioned, for example, a conference in 1989 called Administrative Law Retrospect and Prospect. Now, it was the first major publication before the AIAL Forum, but many of the papers from there are still highly valuable. For example, the best papers on the intersection of executive policy and legal principle come from that publication. The next one to follow, one called Fair and Open Decision Making, which was the first conference that was badged as an AIL conference, equally has a number of important papers that still resonate very strongly if one is examining fundamental underlying principles in public law. A couple of other standouts. The first series of the National Lecture Series in Administrative Law that were given by Sir Anthony Mason, extraordinary scholarly publications. He gave three lectures around Australia. He set a standard that even that the AIAL was unable to continue over the years, but they are still excellent publications. There's a couple that I've found amusing because of the impact they've had. For example, one by Michael Sasella at an AIL conference in which he was a senior legal officer in the Department of Social Security, and he gave a paper, for example, expressing the view that the Administrative Appeals Tribunal was driving administrators to distraction because of its failure to understand how the merits of decision making were reached. And so that became quite a topical and much discussed article because it was just provocative and opinionated, and so I enjoyed it thoroughly. So there are so the ones, in summary, I've enjoyed some of the really thorough scholarly articles that have published in AIL, but I've also enjoyed the very provocative and opinionated articles as well.
Yeah, certainly going to the aims of the Institute, which is, to promote debate and awareness. So certainly, if that's having that impact, it's achieving its objective. There's been a wide range of people and some colourful personalities involved in AIAL over the years. Are there any that stand out particularly for you?
Firstly, what stands out for me is just the range of senior people who've intersected with the AIAL at different times and taken leadership positions in it. The first meeting we had, people who had a marked impact, Jack Richardson, Robert Todd, Dennis Pierce, so I valued their contact and contribution. At a number of conferences, we've had senior officials from government and the judiciary who've both presented papers and then joined in all the activities at the AIL dinner. For example, I remember one dinner where the there was a very vigorous competition in the administrative law quiz, and the table that was probably the most competitive had Justice French, later Chief Justice French, at the table. So it was good just to see the social and scholarly interaction that you got. I worked very closely over many years in the AIAL with Stephen Argument, who was the secretary, and Stephen made an enormous contribution and a very colourful contribution at times too. Stephen and I have remained friends through all the ups and downs, and so I'd especially acknowledge Stephen's contribution to the AIL. Finally, I should mention the first two administrative support people we had, Jenny Kelly and Kathy Malcolm from the Institute of Public Administration. They were our initially they were our secretariat support, and they were sort of lovely people and also made a very professional contribution on how to build and administer an organisation.
And so turning now to sort of administrative law more generally, what do you think have been some of the most significant developments since you first started practicing administrative law?
On the positive side, Margaret, I think the most significant development has been the growth in alternative methods of administrative law review. And here I single out, for example, the development of complaint handling as a fundamental element of good service delivery and review in any organisation. The Ombudsman was really the first of the external review organisations, but now, you know, a commitment to good complaint handling runs through all organisations, public and private, and, you know, there are a whole range of professional courses and bodies and standards that deal with complaint handling. And so I think that's been a highly significant development in Australia. On the negative side, I felt for a long while that the development of jurisdictional error as the focus of judicial review and of legal principle on decision making has had a mystifying and largely counterproductive effect. The concept of jurisdictional error, for example, has completely overshadowed the grounds for review defined in the Administrative Decisions Judicial Review Act. I find the 18 or so grounds that in the ADJR Act provide an excellent framework for examining the elements of good legal decision making, and yet they've largely been sidelined by the development of jurisdictional error as the alternative framework for legal analysis.
And what do you think, going on from that, are some of the top issues or challenges for our administrative law system at the moment?
Margaret, I've always thought that the single biggest challenge in administrative law review is to recognise that there is enormous insight, skill and talent on the executive side of government. They make mistakes, and that's why we have independent review and administrative law accountability. But there are skills that have to be understood and are harder to demonstrate. Among the most talented people I've worked with over the years are senior people in government who are very outcome output focused, who have great experience, wisdom, sagacity. It's hard in an adversarial forum to place weight on insight, wisdom and sagacity, and yet it's the key element of good administration and good service delivery. And so I think that the challenge always is not to downplay the role that that plays in good decision making, and that adversarial forums should, demonstrate, an element of deference towards the understanding and experience that comes from the other side of government.
And what advice would you give someone starting out as a public lawyer now?
There are a great range of opportunities available to work in government, to work in legal practice, to work as a research associate with a tribunal or an independent body, to work in community legal practice, to do part-time or full-time teaching. And I would urge anybody to delve into all of those activities. There's great pressure at times, to define one's career at an early stage, and that's important. But I think it's very important also to sort of rustle up your act from time to time and to do something different. to see law from a different perspective or angle, to engage with a different community of lawyers or practitioners. So that's my key advice to somebody. Make sure that you experience the diversity of that government and law can offer up to somebody's career development.
So I want to ask you a question now, which I'm just fascinated actually to hear to the answer to. Do you have a favourite legal case?
I probably do, Margaret. And the case I'd select, I would select for all the wrong reasons. The case that's probably fascinated me most over the years was Kiowa and West, which is heralded as a defining High Court decision in extending the application of administrative of natural justice. Now, I was interested in that in the lead up to Kiowa and West. The High Court had made a decision in cases like Salimi, saying that a person who is seeking a migrant entry or a visa has no recognisable legal interest to pursue. They have only a hope. They're an outsider, and so they are not owed natural justice or procedural fairness in any way. Many people felt uneasy about that rather dismissive and dogmatic approach from the High Court, and it was recognised that the High Court would have to move. Now, as so often happens, courts seize a particular case in order to change legal principle, and Kiowa and West was that case in which the High Court by majority said that there'd been a fundamental breach of fairness by the Department of Immigration, and that people who were seeking migrant entry, even if they'd overstayed a visa, were owed procedural fairness. However, the uneasy thing about Kiowa and West is that the facts of the case don't support the reasoning in the case. If one reads the facts closely, particularly the excellent dissenting judgment of Sir Harry Gibbs, the Chief Justice, it was very clear that the Kiowas were given natural justice, and the High Court comments that they weren't were a very exaggerated reading of the facts. And I always felt that, and indeed on a research study I was once doing, I got permission from the Department of Immigration at the time to read the file. And it was very clear to me reading the file that the applicants were given natural justice on not one but on frequent occasions. And the comment on which the High Court sees, which an administrator said, well, we're concerned about the way we're concerned about some of the arguments that had been put. That was a concern that was raised simply in response to a submission that the Kiowa's lawyers had put forward. So in summary, while I think that Kiowa is a very interesting and defining case in Australian administrative law, I think the High Court reached the wrong decision on the facts of the case. And so there tends to be a lot of mythology surrounding how the case was decided.
Thank you. And leaving aside academic writings, do you have a favourite book which deals with the law or a legal topic?
I think some of my favourite books, Margaret, are probably ones that were written by lawyers with whom I had some sort of sympathy for the case that they were putting, probably early on in my career. Whether the book that influenced me most of all was The Greening of America by Charles Reich. Charles Reich was a young Yale law academic, and he wrote this book, The Greening of America, that talked about the liberalisation of American culture and the growth of public interest law and things like that that had a marked impact at the time. I enjoyed that. In more recent times, one that I've really enjoyed of a similar kind was a book called Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, who was fellow who'd grown up in the Appalachian hills, eventually went on, I think it was to Yale University, and did law and became a partner in a Washington law firm. And it's just a fascinating insight into the life of somebody and how they, you know, why they chose a legal career and how that intersected with their life in a professional and personal way.
Yes, I've read that book actually, and similarly found it to be a really fascinating story with a lot of insights in it. Do you actually have any time when you're not thinking about legal issues to do other things? Tell us what you do when you're not being an esteemed administrative lawyer.
That's a nice flattering way of putting it, Margaret. I just like hanging around, having an ordinary life. I have a house with a large block that, you know, just looking after the garden takes a while. It's a work in process, but, you know, I like building little, you know, ponds and waterfalls and little villages in the backyard. So I find that, you know, an interesting diversion. Almost all suburbs in Canberra are accessible to the hills. I enjoy sort of wandering around or jogging around the hills in Canberra. I have daughters and grandchildren. Fortunately, most of them live in Melbourne at the moment, which is hard to access, but I enjoy that sort of friendly family contact as well.
And finally, John, to close us out, we are going to ask you whether or not you have a favourite piece of music or a composer that you'd like to share with us.
I think the one I frequently go back to, Margaret, particularly for a long drive, is Les Miserables. I just find the music stirring. I love the story. I love the simple messages in the play about, you know, how single acts of kindness can transform a person's life. It's about the right length of a CD for a drive from Canberra to Sydney. So I think I'd single that out as probably the piece of music that I've listened to more than any other in my life and continue to return to it.
Well, John, I'd like to thank you so much for talking us today and sharing your thoughts and experiences. It's been wonderful to talk to you, and certainly I've gained a lot of insight from the things that you've said, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. And can I also just acknowledge the support of Robert Orr in the production of this podcast? Thanks very much, John.
Thank you, Margaret, and thank you, Robert, for the opportunity to participate in yet another worthwhile AIAL endeavour.
One day more, another day, another destiny, this never-ending road to Calvary. These men who seem to know my crime will surely come a second time. One day more,
did not live until today. How can I live when we are parted?
One day more,
tomorrow you'll